I'm Mark Franklin, practice leader of a team of professional career counselors at careercycles.com and founder of One Life Tools. I'm pleased to be your host today on Career Buzz, Canada's unique podcast conversation that enriches lives, empowers careers, and energizes organizations. From mergers to downsizings, 70% of corporate change initiatives fail. The culprit, in most cases, is terrible communication, which allows a combination of vivid imaginations and social media-fueled rumors to create a mess that may then take years to fix. Elizabeth Williams has learned the lessons from epic change failures. She developed simple techniques to get the right message out to the right people at the right time. What's the secret weapon that makes organizational communications successful? Elizabeth Williams joins me live in studio to answer those questions. Welcome to Career Buzz, Elizabeth.
Oh, it's great to be here, Mark. Thank you.
So what do you like about all the things that are going on in your career these days?
Well, what I love is I've recently started up my own consulting company, and so I'm both learning to be an entrepreneur and also enjoying the many personal benefits that come along with working for yourself. And it's been really lovely to be able to apply more years than I'll admit worth of experience to new problems from, you know, new clients.
And as a consultant and business owner, what are all the hats that you wear? What's a typical week look like?
I don't have a typical week. I'm waiting for one. And I can be on site at a client's 2 days, working at a Starbucks, you know, another day, or in my, you know, gross track pants and slippers for another day. And those are the good days. So yeah, I mean, no two projects are the same and no two problems are the same. And that's, I think, one of the things I like is there's a huge amount of variety and a huge number of different problems I get to come at different ways.
Now, you've had quite an interesting career trajectory in corporate communications. Where did it all begin?
Well, it all began as a journalist. That was what I went to school for. And I was briefly a journalist long enough to know that I didn't want to be a journalist. And like most failed journalists, I went into corporate communications because you get to apply the skill set, but you don't have to stay up late. And
Wait, is that the reason why you didn't like journalism, staying up too late, or were there other things that you didn't like?
I just didn't want to be a daily assignment reporter, I realized. And, you know, you go to journalism school and that's the thing, right? Go get a job, go be a reporter. And I was lucky enough, I got a great job on a major daily in Toronto and I hated it. It wasn't my thing. And I think it's either in your blood or it's not in your blood, and it wasn't in mine. And so I was lucky enough to land a job as a corporate communications person. I didn't even really know what that was. They just said, we need a writer.
How did you connect those dots, right? I mean, nowadays, I think it's much more common because journalism is a challenging career because of all the changes mm-hmm. there. But, you know, I think more and more journalists are thinking about corporate communications because that path is a little more well trod now. But back then, how did you even know to think, oh, I should go into corporate communications?
I actually didn't have the slightest idea that there was a thing called corporate communications. And I applied for a job for a writer in a big insurance company. And I thought, well, how hard can that be? And harder than it looks, but you still get to go home at 5. And so I took this job as a writer, and it turned out that a lot of what I was writing was proposals and things that went to customers. But an awful lot of the other work that was coming my way, once they find out there's a writer in the house, all of a sudden you're the most popular person in the room. And so I had them coming, can you help me with a newsletter? I need to communicate with some employees about a change. I need to hire a bunch of people. We have a contest. It's the holiday party. All this stuff just starts sort of washing up. And I found out later that they called it corporate communications. And went out and found out that there were a bunch of people just like me. And I found some great local organizations. The International Association of Business Communicators has a fantastic local chapter. And I thought, oh, this is a real job. This isn't writing in an insurance company. This is like a real job. And so, and it's a fascinating job because you get to touch every corner of the organization. So you are as plugged in at the C-suite as you are in the loading dock. And you get to see the value of what you do. When you do it well, it's magical. And when it goes horribly wrong, it's a complete disaster. And so there's a fair bit of pressure, but I think it's one of the most rewarding things you can do if you're good at communicating.
So Elizabeth, now that you discovered corporate communications and it's a thing, I know there was a number of jobs that you had there. What are a couple of key turning points for you over the course of that corporate communications career that you had?
Well, Well, I did the corporate communications thing for a number of years, and there's a sort of murky line between corporate communications and marketing communications. And in companies where maybe they don't have a marketing department, or they don't have a big marketing department, or they don't think they do marketing, the two can blur. And that was very much happening to me. So now I was getting people coming to me saying, well, can you help me with a little ad I need to write, or can you help me with a press release? And so it sort of just kept getting bigger. And I was looking around thinking, well, this marketing thing looks way sexier than employee newsletters. And it was the tech boom. And I had the opportunity, I was offered a job to go do marketing communications for a technology company. And I thought, all right, I'm out of here. And the amount of adrenaline that comes along with marketing and technology is addicting. So as much as corporate communications is more like a craft and a thing you just do well in the dark, and you know, behold, there's your result. Marketing, I discovered, was just moving 1,000 miles an hour, and I was working in networking technologies, which is dead sexy. But at the time, it was the thing, and it was very fast moving, and there's a ton of competition, and yeah, I was just scrambling, and I loved it. I loved the adrenaline. I loved the chase. I loved the creativity. I loved the ability to take those communication skills and build on them and build in strategy. So corporate communications, there's strategy involved, but it's largely an internal strategy, or it's a messaging strategy. With marketing, it's a lot more complex, and I liked the complexity.
It's so interesting to hear you say, you know, adrenaline rush when it comes to a job that at first was called writer. You know, and lots of people get into writing because they're more quiet. They might be have a personality that's more introverted. Mm-hmm. And yet you're talking about kind of fast-paced, adrenaline, adventure, kind of like what people go into journalism for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you were sharing any advice with people who are good writers listening to the show today, you know, who might be thinking, gee, what job is there for me? Maybe I'll be a journalist, but heck, that's a problem because look at all the newspapers. What would you say about the ways to get into communications and corporate communications, you know, and what to expect? Because people might think it's kind of dreary, and yet you're talking about adrenaline rushes.
I mean, I think you can, it's one of those jobs where you can almost make it what you want it to be. And I was fortunate enough because I was the first person in this company who was the, in air quotes, corporate communicator. They started calling me that after the writer thing got old. And I could, I found, and I don't know if that's everyone's experience, but I certainly had the privilege to sort of say, wow, I'm interested in electronic publishing. I'm going to go learn about that and bring that back to the organization. And they were receptive. And I'm interested in employee engagement, so I'm going to go be a lot nicer to the HR people. And I'm interested in executive communication. I'm interested in helping executives build their brands. And those are all just sort of peripheral things. And so my advice would be, if you're a good writer and the thought of sitting in your track pants and slippers 8 hours a day for the rest of your life is a little bit daunting, then take that skill, because it's so needed in the workplace right now, and go find a job in corporate communications, or find a job in marketing, or content marketing is the thing we call, what used to be called marketing communications, and there's a lot of work out there for good content marketers. And you know, you get to touch so many aspects of the business and the product and the market, and sooner or later I think you find your level.
Nice. And I know some of the colleges even have programs now that are very focused on communications or corporate communications as a thing, as a job. And even in universities, you're going to end up, you know, in lots of programs doing a lot of writing, and those writing mm-hmm. skills would be transferable to those jobs.
Well, yeah. And in fact, I'm doing some work right now. I'm looking into executive communication skills. And one of the things I'm discovering is that our MBA programs are cranking out these really smart, really strategic people who really struggle to make themselves understood in everyday writing and in everyday speaking. And they're great at putting stuff on PowerPoints and presenting a case study, but they're really struggling to communicate to other stakeholders. And so I think I'm really pleased to hear that the colleges and universities are putting a focus back on corporate communications, because really, you know, after I kind of left that and went off to the bright lights of marketing, I was noticing an awful lot of the larger companies were gutting their communication departments, or they were sort of dismantling them and sending a couple of people to work with HR and a few people to work in marketing. And so that skill set and that institutional knowledge very much left corporate Canada for a number of years. And I think we're seeing the payback for that in, you know, some fairly public little scandals, and from things that just get out and run around in the ether that probably should never have gotten outside the building, and a good corporate communications person would have stopped that.
So what are a couple of highlights? I know you worked for several notable organizations throughout your career. What are a couple of key highlights that you can share with listeners?
Oh my goodness, I've just worked for some of the best companies, in the world, in my view. When I was at the Bank of Montreal, I got to work on the ePost launch, and that was, at least in the day, that was quite a thing. And it was fascinating because we were having to define a technology, and it was a bank and the post office working together, trying to define a technology and then explain it to Canadians. And, you know, now we pay bills online, we don't think about it. But then it was a big deal, and it was a very complicated thing. And I got to work with some of the smartest people in Canada, economists and bankers and strategists, just from the very top firms. And so that was like I got an MBA all by myself in 6 months on that one. I worked for Rogers for many years, and I got to work with the launching Apple products into the business market. And again, what's an iPad? We take it for granted now, but when you're having to say, here's this thing and it's flat and it's bigger than a phone, but it's not quite a TV and it does all these cool things, it's a really interesting place to be to pull people down that technology continuum. So I just got to work on really great stuff.
And finally, what led you then to leave some of these great companies you just mentioned, Bank of Montreal, Rogers, like all these really corporate titans, and now here you are running your own show? What led to that big change more recently?
The thing that led to that more than anything was I realized that the thing that I loved to do the most, is I was getting restless, and I actually did a little bit of introspection, which, you know, first time in 20 years I thought about my career. And I thought, the thing that makes me happiest is actually the corporate communication stuff. And so when I left Rogers, I landed at ADP Canada, which is, as you know, large payroll and HR company, and in a corporate communications role. And it just felt like putting on a really familiar old sweater. And it was like, yes, this is where I belong. I like this stuff. I like the strategy. And I felt like I had enough miles on me, I guess, that I could really bring a perspective. And when you come at it with a bit of a marketing perspective, I think you bring persuasion skills. And I think given the workforce that we have now, we've got generation, the millennials are the bulk of the workforce now. And so these are people who are used to bite-sized, powerful, impactful communications. They're not going to sit down and read 400 words on the new benefits program. They just give me a picture, tell me what to do, and let me go on. And I think I had the opportunity to come back into it with a perspective on digital marketing and how you sell things, how you persuade. So persuasion is the same thing on either side of the wall, just one of them you're separating people from their money, and the other you're separating people from their time. And so, you know, we need to start putting more value, I think, on that. And then working in the HR space as a communications person, and as I did a bit of marketing there as well, I came to realize that for most companies, the biggest threat to their brand isn't their competitors or the economy or their products. It's the people who represent that brand day in and day out, and not just salespeople and not just frontline people, but everybody who touches any part of your product or your brand brings all the baggage of what it's like to work there to that experience. And so I began to think really hard about employer branding, which I had at first sort of thought, I don't know what that is. It sounds fluffy. I'm not doing it. And then the more I dug into it, the more I realized it's not fluffy. It's the other half of the branding Pop-Tart, one half being the market brand, which is how your customers...
Consumer facing, yeah.
Yeah, so it's what your customers and potential customers think of you. But if you don't get the internal thing right, the what do your employees and potential employees and past employees think of you, then you are setting yourself up to fail on the external side. And I think the other way around too. I mean, it's not a lot of fun working for a brand that is perhaps a little tarnished in the marketplace. And so as I thought about that, I thought there's no one really having that conversation. And so that's why I decided to hang out my own shingle, because I thought that's where I want to go next. And I couldn't figure out a way to do that in a corporate context and have the impact I wanted.
So I said off the top, which was a stat that you gave me, about the number of organizational change initiatives that fail was a whopping 70%, mm-hmm. which is, that's a pretty hefty number. What is the problem?
Well, I mean, organizational change fails for a bunch of reasons, but I think the most common and the most preventable is terrible communication. And it can take the form of And usually it takes the form of just not enough. And so you go ahead and put together a really great strategy to make some change. So I'll tell you about one I worked on years ago. There was a new accounting system being put into a large organization, replacing a bunch of clunky old ones. Everybody thought this was a terrific idea. And they formed a project team and they got the best project manager and they funded it properly and they got executive sponsorship and it sent out a fantastic email saying, you know, Project Snowball, I think, is, you know, on the way and isn't this great? And everybody said, yay. And 30 months later, they were ready to have employees start testing it, but they hadn't said a word in the intervening year and a half. And so in an organization of that size, you've had probably hundreds, maybe even 1,000 people leave. So you've got at least 1,000 people who have no idea what Project Snowball is. You've got the rest of the people who haven't thought about it in 2.5 years. I mean, I don't remember my email from last week, let alone 2 years ago. And so now they had this brilliant thing that they were rolling out. They had a sense of urgency. They needed people to actually do things. And suddenly you had a whole organization that was saying, wait a minute, what's this? Oh, I don't think I like this. This looks hard. This looks like it's threatening me. I like the old system. I work on the old system. Is my job safe? What about my processes? And so the whole thing just turned into a giant mess. And the interesting thing is I went in and I actually talked to the project team and they thought they were doing a terrific job. They're like, no, we're communicating. Every week we have a status meeting and we write up a summary and we send it up to the executives and they review it every month. And so we communicated. And so the obvious miss there is, and this is rampant in organizations, this assumption that if you tell the executives, it'll magically work its way down through the organization. And I think the thing I've learned over the years is there's no such thing as cascading information. Mm.
So the fail is communicating frequently enough and widely enough, not just to the executives, but everybody kind of needs to know, because ultimately all those employees are the ones who are using the system or connecting with it. Mm-hmm. So in this case, what happened? Were you the one who was brought in, like the turnaround agent, come and fix this problem?
Yeah, I was the cavalry on this one. And we got there eventually, but we had to admit, we had to sort of go out and say, yeah, we should have told you more. We had to bring our management teams, our frontline managers and our middle managers on site very, very quickly and help them understand this is the context, this is what's happening. I like to use this sort of is, does, means structure. So here's what it is, here's what this does, and here's what it means, and here's what you need to say to help people understand what's going to change in their world. And so we did. It sort of felt like we had let the project down, though, because they had worked so hard, and it was one of those rare giant organizational projects that actually came in on time, on budget. The change was doing what it was supposed to do. It was having the results it was intended to have. And the whole thing went off a cliff because we created all this resistance in the organization. We created friction. And the primary place we created that friction, and this goes to the other thing you said about the secret weapon, the primary place we created friction was frontline managers. Because as soon as that message goes out that says, here's this change, and whether it's an okay change like an accounting system or a not okay change like a downsizing or something that's, you know, happening, if your frontline managers don't know and can't talk to employees, you've got a big problem, because frontline managers are far and away the most trusted source of information for employees, way more than the CEO or senior executives. They go to their frontline manager, and when they get there, if that frontline manager just looks at them and says, I got nothing, you two things happen. One, your employee thinks, oh, you know,
it's unimportant.
It's not important, yeah. Or my manager doesn't know what he or she is doing. The manager feels a little exposed, like their credibility has been reduced, and it has. And then they're sort of wondering, well, you know, what am I? Like, why don't I know this? I'm a manager. And so we create all these points of friction. And in fact, I think if you do it badly enough, you can almost create what I call the sort of the internal resistance. And that can start with your frontline managers. And if your frontline managers decide, you know what, I'm not supporting this because you didn't bring me in the loop, you're not helping me be effective, and you're making me look like an idiot in front of my team. If you do that, you've now set up a whole set of resistance all across the organization. And that's where these things can really just implode, because now you don't have buy-in, you don't have engagement. And that's a very hard hole to get out of.
So one of the answers, or one of the secret weapons, is communicating frequently and often, especially bringing in those frontline managers. So what else? What else is part of the solution? You know, there must be so many ideas if 70% of change fails. So what else can organizations do or ask themselves to keep this on the right track instead of having to apologize afterwards for the mishaps?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing really is just include it in the planning process. When we do these big changes, even if they're changes that come fairly quickly, like a merger or an acquisition, or if you have to do some downsizing, that doesn't happen overnight. That happens over the course of weeks or months, or in the case of a new system, years. And so you actually have the time to put that on the table at the beginning and to sit down, and it's actually not rocket science. It's sitting down and deliberately saying, well, who's going to be affected by this change? And what do they need to understand to be okay with it? They may not like it. Nobody likes a downsizing, but what do they have to understand about why we're doing this? What context do they need? And then from there, you can really work out in not a whole lot of time, what do we need to tell them? What's the best way to tell them? What are the best channels? Who's the most credible person to tell them? And you can give everybody a role. So you can give those frontline managers enough routine information that they are in the loop and they can do stuff, and you can set your senior executives up to be the face of the change and to be kind of the brand owners of the change, and you can put it out there in formats that work for your employee base. It can be, you can tweet it. I mean, you know, we have politicians who tweet policy these days, so Twitter is as legitimate a platform as anything. You can put it on an internal thing like Slack. You can do good old-fashioned emails. You can do posters. I think we forget a lot of people in the workplace don't actually sit in front of a computer. They're in a warehouse, or they're in a car, or they're running equipment somewhere.
If people are investing, Elizabeth, in the both the money of an internal communications group or an external consultant like you, and it costs a bunch of money for you to come in and do stuff, what's the return on investment? How can you convince somebody when the problem hasn't happened yet? You know, and they don't know that it's going to happen. You know it's going to happen, but before it happens, how do you say that? How do you say here's why you should invest in this?
So we can come at it two ways. You can just scare them to death with some of the well-known failures of corporate transformation that are written
up. Of which there are many these days.
There is no shortage. And you can say, you know, these are some documented cases about what happens when you don't communicate properly. And arguably Enron is a great example of that. So sometimes just saying Enron will get them on side. But I prefer to ladder it up to the things that executives care about anyway. And so we have abundant evidence that good employers, top employers, outperform the S&P substantially by 86%. They outperform the market by over 100%. We know that top employers have much higher retention. They have much lower absenteeism. They have more productivity. I mean, all the metrics that executives care about are directly affected by the extent to which you have a good workplace, an engaged workforce. And you can connect good communication, and not just during change. I think good communication across the board all the time, to being a top employer. So I always say that it's not us, it's not the complete solution. It'll keep you out of hot water temporarily while you're doing a change, but you need to continue to invest in the way you communicate to your employees, because it's going to drive employee engagement. And we know that employee engagement is pretty appalling. Only 13% of the workforce in this country is actually highly engaged in its work, and it's been that way for a generation. And so when you've got 70% of the workforce disengaged and 14% of the workforce trying to figure out how to steal the filing cabinets, they're that disengaged, you know, you probably want to start looking at more and better communication rather than less communication.
Just coming back to the personal, you told us earlier, Elizabeth Williams, about your career trajectory and how you started journalism and then a writer and then corporate communications. What's one thing that you could share with listeners about what you've learned about making good choices?
The thing I've learned is that the fear is really the biggest thing that gets in your way. It certainly was for me. I mean, I had wanted to go on my own on and off over the years. And it was always just, there's a kid, or there was tuition to pay, or there was something. And it was always just felt too risky. And I've realized since I screwed up the courage to jump off the cliff that, you know, nothing bad is going to happen. Mm. And I've changed jobs a lot, which concerns my mother deeply. But yeah, so I would say that if I had to do it again, I would take more chances. I would try new things. I would take those jobs that seemed a little strange and icky. I would more actively seek assignments elsewhere in organizations, or even just you know, muscle my way into some project that I have no business being a part of, because I think that your value increases exponentially with the amount you learn.
Great advice. Elizabeth Williams, thanks so much for joining us here. If people want to find out more about you or get in touch, how do they do that?
You can find me at my website, candlerchase.com, or you can look me up on LinkedIn.
Thank you for listening to the Career Buzz podcast. Find us on iTunes or visit careercycles.com/radio to subscribe and download past episodes. Get inspiring career stories full of twists and turns, actionable ideas from career experts, and new ideas to empower your own career and life.